Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off today. A much-anticipated interview with adult film star Stormy Daniels aired last night on CBS's 60 Minutes program. Daniels claims to have had an affair with Donald Trump before he was president back in 2006. Daniels, also known as Stephanie Clifford, signed a non-disclosure agreement, ostensibly to stay quiet about the affair just days before the election in 2016, an agreement which paid her $130,000. She now claims the deal is void because Trump never signed it. And Daniels says she signed the agreement because she was concerned about her safety and that of her young daughter. Daniels was interviewed on 60 Minutes by Anderson Cooper, and here with us this hour to offer analysis, Philadelphia-based attorney Max Kennerly is in studio with us. Welcome to Radio Times, Max.
Good morning.
And Washington Post senior reporter Frances Sellers joins us from the Washington Post studios in Washington, D.C. Great to have you along, Frances.
Glad to be there with you this morning.
And the number to call to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or also a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes. So to begin, and Max, to you first on this, what did we learn last night that was new regarding this alleged affair?
I think most of what we learned last night was more a confirmation of what we had suspected and what had been described about the relationship that Ms. Clifford's had with Mr. Trump, the nature of this agreement that she reached with Mr. Cohen and this Essential Consultants LLC shell corporation.
So Mr. Cohen is Mr. Trump's attorney.
Correct.
Trump's attorney, yeah.
And I think a lot of what we learned from the interview followed up on what's been implied from the lawsuit that her attorney filed by tweets and various other secondary discussions. But we didn't really learn a whole lot new that we hadn't inferred from it before. Now, there is, however, one additional element, which is her recollection of a time that she was, in her words, she was intimidated by someone that she at least believed was affiliated somehow with Trump's lawyer, Mr. Cohen, or with Trump himself. And it was a threat directed at her with reference to her young daughter at the same time. And so that part was new. There hadn't been an indication of that before. And Mr. Cohen, on his own behalf, I believe, has already sent a letter to her and her attorney to stop repeating these falsehoods, to say it was inappropriate to imply that he or Mr. Trump had any sort of connection with this alleged intimidation. So that component of it is new, as well as her discussion of what legally we'd call duress, of where you sign something or you agree to something, not because you've sat down and fairly thought about it and you want to do it, but because you feel compelled by some sort of threat one way or another.
We have a lot to examine this hour. Let's bring Frances into the conversation. Frances, what is your take on last night's program? What's your perspective as to whether there's any groundbreaking news that came out of it?
Well, there'd been a lot of build-up to this interview, right? The attorney who represents Stormy Daniels, Michael Avenatti, had tweeted almost from the moment the interview happened that there was going to be an event on 60 Minutes. He tweeted twice pictures of Stormy Daniels and Anderson Cooper, and then this DVD. So I think there was a lot of build-up, and then, as we've just heard, not very much that was new in terms of allegations. And we should be clear in this discussion, these are allegations that Trump's representatives have denied an affair on his behalf. So we're talking about allegations Stormy Daniels has made. The Las Vegas allegation is a very striking new piece of information. And one, of course, a lot of people are going to be trying to corroborate and pin down. It was presented as an event that almost any mother would, parent would relate to very emotionally. She describes getting out of her car with her infant in a car seat on the way to a workout class and being approached by somebody who allegedly threatened her. That was, I think, a piece of information that a lot of people will be wanting to follow up on and understand better.
Yeah. And as a matter of
new piece of information was the FedEx envelope that Mr. Avenatti presented, which suggests that Mr. Cohen may have been acting as a representative of the Trump organization in his dealings with Stormy Daniels' previous attorney, Keith Davidson.
Okay, and we're going to get to that FedEx envelope as well. But the story that Stormy Daniels told about the incident in Las Vegas, we do have a clip of her during the show last night in which she talks about this. And we're going to air that right now. And then it's going to be immediately followed by a clip of Michael Avenatti, who is Stormy Daniels' lawyer. So let's take a listen first to what Stormy Daniels had to say about that alleged incident.
I was in a parking lot going to a fitness class with my infant daughter. I was taking, you know, the seats facing backwards in the back seat, diaper bag, you know, getting all the stuff out. And a guy walked up on me and said to me, "Leave Trump alone, forget the story." And then he leaned around and looked at my daughter and said, "It's a beautiful little girl. It'd be a shame if something happened to her mom." And then he was gone.
Did you go to the police?
No.
Why?
Because I was scared.
This is about the cover-up. This is about the extent that Mr. Cohen and the president have gone to intimidate this woman, to silence her, to threaten her, and to put her under their thumb. It is thuggish behavior.
Max, let's go to you first on this. And let's talk about actually, as Francis had referenced, there's going to be a lot of investigation or looking into this particular alleged incident. She didn't go to the police. So really, when you're trying to follow a trail, what can you follow legally in order to make something of this, to confirm it?
Well, it is difficult to confirm an allegation involving something that happened many years ago. You know, and oftentimes people, when they review a situation like this, will jump to, well, she didn't go to the police immediately. She didn't report it immediately. But on the flip side, you know, if we were talking about criminal prosecution of, you know, a drug gang or some other large organization, and a witness testified that they were intimidated for a number of years and that's why they didn't report it to the police, no one would bat an eye. You know, the concept of intimidation and fear preventing people from reporting something is pretty commonplace. And, you know, most of us have seen somewhere in our lives somewhere where that happened, where there is something that you could have reported to the police, but you did not. You wanted to end it. You wanted to move on with your life. It does make it challenging to attempt to identify first who this was, which would be somewhat essential if you're going to try and, you know, connect this back to Mr. Trump or Mr. Cohen. You would want to start with at least who it was. And then second would be some sort of proof that they were connected to Mr. Trump or Mr. Cohen, as compared to someone who has secondarily sought some sort of intervention in this. You know, down in Alabama just recently, one of the accusers against Roy Moore, their attorney raised the situation right before the election in which he was approached to accept $10,000 in exchange for publishing a statement in which he said he was rejecting his client because he didn't believe her. And, of course, the lawyer then looked at this and said, well, that's ridiculous. I can't ethically do this. I'd lose my license. Mm-hmm. But the point here is there's no direct connection between them and Roy Moore. They may just be Roy Moore supporters. Now, with Ms. Clifford's or Stormy Daniels, with her situation in the past, it is a bit different because if this happened, who else would know that she had some sort of relationship with Mr. Trump? And who else would know that this was bothering Mr. Trump? You know, it wasn't the sort of public knowledge that it is now, in which any person coming up on the street could be, for all we know, some sort of Trump supporter. In that context, if this happened, it does raise the question of, well, how would anyone have known, one, who she was, and two, that she had anything to do with Mr. Trump, unless it originated from him? Now, that said, given the age of the evidence and when this happened, the likelihood of us learning anything else about this is pretty slim.
And Francis, again, Michael Cohen has already said, you know, he sent a cease and desist letter to Michael Avenatti, you know, saying, you know, that he and Ms. Clifford, Stephanie Clifford, a.k.a. Stormy Daniels, have defamed Mr. Cohen in relation to the threat she says she received.
So his lawyer, yes, Brent Blakely, sent out a letter last night, as you outlined. I think the point that's just been raised is a very good one, that there are very few people in 2011 who allegedly could have known about this event. Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels' story is that she had been she'd given her interview in May 2011 to Bauer Publications, a celebrity magazine. So there must have been a number of people there who knew of her story, the reporter and editors there, and then a very limited other number of people who had helped her take that story to Bauer. Bauer is the publisher of In Touch magazine, where the interview finally ran in January of this year. And any lawyers who are involved in, as we say, lawyering a story, checking a story to see if its facts are correct.
Let's get to the $130,000 that Michael Cohen, President Trump's attorney, gave to Stormy Daniels in relation to this non-disclosure agreement. Are we talking possible violations of campaign finance law that could reach President Trump, or is this a stretch, Max?
Well, I don't think it's a stretch because, you know, we see here in Philadelphia a lot of instances in which politicians, not for a nefarious reason and not to cover up something as salacious as this, but where politicians misstate their campaign contributions. And sometimes this is a pure accounting error of, you know, there were two contributions that should have been put into 1 year or two contributions that should have been split across 2 years. But the laws about campaign finance contributions are pretty strict in terms of the disclosure. You know, we have Citizens United. We have a whole open free speech arena for this dark money to come to support a candidate or not support a candidate. But when it comes to the benefits provided to a candidate or to a campaign, in that context, the disclosure rules are pretty strict. And here the issue would be, since this is happening right before the election, since it appears to be an issue for the benefit of the Trump campaign, you know, this is the timing of this $130,000 payment is right after the Access Hollywood tape. It's right before the election. That sort of situation creates the appearance that this $130,000 from Mr. Cohen was for the benefit of the Trump campaign. Now, if that's the case,
appears to be. I'm sorry for interrupting you. Appears to be, but do you believe there might be enough evidence to connect the dots?
I think there is. I think contextually there is. And in terms of campaign finance disclosure, you know, the issue isn't can you prove definitively that this was for the benefit of the campaign. The issue is the disclosure. And I think if you ran this scenario by any election lawyer of I'm going to pay this money to someone to benefit the Trump campaign and keep a story silent that could affect their campaign, all of the election lawyers that you'd ask this of would say that is likely an in-kind contribution.
So if there are violations that are found of the campaign finance law, how does this affect President Trump?
President Trump himself is – well, you know, it's a saying we have among a lot of lawyers these days, which is that President Trump is a walking, talking bar exam. And so, you know, you could go down so many different roads with the legal issues that he raises. So for him personally, you know, to ask the effect of this campaign finance potential violation, or at least a lack of disclosure, you have to start with a question that still is unanswered in this entire, you know, scenario, which is what was his role? What was his connection to the Stormy Daniels controversy? Like, where is he in this?
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to talk some more as soon as we finish our break here. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Max Kennerly, trial lawyer in Philadelphia, is with us. Also, Frances Sellers with The Washington Post. Keep it here. More just ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moskowain today. Sunday night's 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels continues to compound the legal woes of President Trump. Today we're talking about what's known about Trump's alleged affair with Daniels, the legal questions the scenario has raised, and what effects it could have on the presidency. In studio with us, Max Kennerly, trial lawyer in Philadelphia, joining us from Washington, D.C. at the studios of The Washington Post. Reporter Frances Sellers, and our number is 888-477-9499 if you'd like to jump into the conversation, or you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And heading into the break, Max, we were talking about the president's personal liability, possible liability here, in relation to any possible violations of campaign law. So if you could just kind of finish your thought on that, and then Francis, I'd like to get your response as well. So
sure. I think with Mr. Cohen, it's a much clearer problem for him in that if he is knowingly providing a $130,000 benefit to the Trump for America campaign, then he has a serious problem on his hands. That would be a violation of campaign finance law if he failed to disclose this, which as far as we can tell, he did. And it could be similarly a problem for Trump for America. For Trump himself, though, you know, this is still the open question in all of this. We know what Stormy Daniels, Ms. Clifford, says about Trump and his role here, but we haven't heard anything from him or from Mr. Cohen.
Well, he's denying that the affair ever happened.
Precisely, yeah. Which then raises the question of, you know, then what is his relationship to this agreement? You know, is he the David Dennison pseudonym in it? And what did he know about this payment? And the interesting part on that is the more he knows about the payment, the better his argument is in the lawsuit over it and the more enforceable the agreement is. However, the more he knows about the payment, the worse it is for him for campaign finance law. So he's in a bit of a bind here, even if he was just going to pick and choose what he wanted to say or argue. If he distanced himself from that payment, then he may have serious problems enforcing his side of that agreement, assuming that that is him with it. But if he's connected to that payment, then he himself could be liable in various ways for the failure to disclose the campaign finance contribution.
Francis Seller, in your role, Francis Sellers, I should say, in your role as observer, what is your take on this?
So I think it's very interesting to see how this was happening right before the election, right? There was a long time before that when the story might have been quashed, but we ran a story a few weeks ago about how Stormy Daniels almost pulled her side of the bargain in the weeks before the election because things weren't moving ahead appropriately. And there was a big effort to get it done right before the election, which certainly suggests that there was an effort to make this deal before the election. That feeds into what Max was saying about, relating that to campaign finance issues. So beyond that, I think, we'll wait and see for more evidence. In terms of the original contract and whether it needed to be signed or not, some lawyers have pointed out to me that it wasn't a standard NDA. It was not simply money for silence. It was actually a two-way contract in which David Dennison also made some promises, therefore requiring, and Max, you might want to broaden this point a bit, therefore requiring signatures on both sides, not just one person.
All right, signature. Let's get to that. So David Dennison, a.k.a. Donald Trump, never signs this agreement. Let's talk about signatures and pseudonyms. First of all, is this a valid agreement without all party signatures?
So if we stepped back and let's just say that you and I had a written agreement where you were going to pay me $130 to shovel the snow out of your driveway. And we drafted all this and we wrote all of it. And then I signed it. You didn't sign it, but you paid me the $130. You know, that's taught in first year law school. That would be acceptance by performance. Mm-hmm. You know, by itself, the failure to sign a contract does not necessarily mean that the contract isn't enforceable. You know, if a party has taken steps that indicate their acceptance of the agreement, if they've performed the side of the agreement that they were supposed to perform, then courts will generally construe that as the parties all accepting and agreeing to the contract. Mm-hmm. However, that's you and I, you know, about snow shoveling.
And we're not talking about pseudonyms here either. I mean,
no.
Do pseudonyms throw a curveball into all this? I mean, the Trump isn't coming out and saying he was David Dennison.
And that's where everything gets much more complicated here, which is, you know, instead of just a simple agreement of Donald Trump pays Stormy Daniels $130,000 and then he pays the money, she takes the money. And if he doesn't sign it, that would still be enforceable. I don't think most courts would have any sort of issue with that. Well, he paid. He did what he was supposed to do. But what they set up here is this Rube Goldberg construction of pseudonyms of a variety of overlapping provisions with this excessive legal language at them, with a shell corporation providing funds for it.
Sounds like there's a huge wall of protection being built.
Precisely.
To kind of, well, ostensibly, allegedly, perhaps, you know, separate Donald Trump from all this.
Precisely. And that's the campaign finance side of it. Mm-hmm. They appeared to be setting up the shell corporation. They appeared to be using the pseudonyms to build a wall between him and the contract. But there's an element of Murphy's Law here. And, you know, he would not be the first person to over-lawyer an agreement and end up making it not enforceable or causing some sort of problems with it. So the signature starts to enter into this issue because of the complexity and the structure of the rest of the agreement. You know, if Donald Trump, aka David Dennison, did not sign this, then the agreement becomes much harder to construe and understand because it's not clear what his role is in this, nor is it clear where the transfers of property or any sort of value would go. You know, as Francis said, there is an element to it right at the beginning of the contract in which it says David Dennison has alleged that that Stormy Daniels had a variety of defamatory remarks against him, that it was damaging to his business. And so his consideration, which, you know, in the law is the value of a contract, his consideration to the agreement is to release his potential claims against Stormy Daniels. Now, as Francis said, though, it doesn't necessarily follow through on that because he himself did not sign or execute that part of the agreement. And then we have the secondary issues of where's that money coming from? Yeah. And this goes back to what I was saying before of thus far, as best we can tell, so the agreement says the money comes from Essential Consultants LLC. And then Michael Cohen says the money came from him personally and wasn't reimbursed.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is the walking, talking bar exam again. You could give this question to law students in a contract class and make them try and figure out, okay, well, what was David Dennison's contribution to this agreement?
Yeah.
You know, did he perform with it? What did he do? What did he get?
Yeah. Francis Sellers, just a quick take from you as to whether, again, in your reporting, it seems as if there's a fairly insular wall here between the White House, the Oval Office, and what's actually happening with this case.
Well, I think really what's so interesting here is that Mr. Avenatti chose to sue and to surface the full agreement in his suit, which he didn't actually need to do to challenge that agreement. But what we're seeing here is the legal issues being played out in the court of public opinion very deliberately.
What do you make of Mr. Avenatti's strategy?
It's exactly what I said. I think he's playing, first of all, in the court of public opinion. He produced a complaint from the start that was written in layman's language so that I didn't need to go to a Max to read it myself. He's surfaced this contract so that other lawyers can look and talk about it. And had he not surfaced it, I think we might have assumed it was a simple NDA. But in fact, it is a more complicated contract. And so these are very interesting moves he's made in order to bring these issues so much to the fore. And then his tweeting is doing the same thing that, you know, he's almost sort of driving the news cycle in some ways.
Yes.
By releasing pieces of information.
And we're going to get to the phones here in just a minute because this conversation is generating some reaction. But I did want to get to something that he posted on Twitter on Thursday, what appeared to be a DVD. And the tweet read, "If a picture is worth 1,000 words, how many words is this worth?" Well, we didn't hear much about that last night. How do you read that, Francis?
You know, he keeps promising us more, so we'll see what comes next. I think it was something that a lot of people went into last night's show expecting to hear more about.
And Max, again, part of his strategy here. Where's he going with this?
I mean, I think there is an element of trying your case in the press, and generally lawyers are taught and advised to not try their case in the press.
But I mean, is your sense that there's a smoking gun here, or is he really just trying to win attention for his case?
I think there is definitely an element of winning attention. You know, the presence of a smoking gun, he certainly implied it with the picture of the DVD there. He might have something. And, you know, the agreement does have different treatments of, you know, this supposed intellectual property of images and text messages as compared to the discussion of confidential information. Now, from Trump's side, they'd consider both of these a breach. But, you know, it is – he does seem to be teasing the public with more out there, and it's really – is it there or is it not?
Well,
and
Stormy Daniels told, you know, her alleged story last night. What would he have had – Avenatti, her lawyer, what would he have had to lose had he given details of what might be on the DVD from a legal standpoint?
Well, from a legal standpoint, it would be, at least in the view of Michael Cohen and essential consultants and presumably Donald Trump, as yet another breach and more fuel to add to the fire. Now, I think one legal difference, though, is Stormy Daniels does have a pretty colorable, you know, meritorious claim about how she did not start breaching this. She came forward after Michael Cohen started discussing it publicly himself. And, you know, he described it as the money coming from himself personally, which Ms. Daniels says is incorrect, and that it was supposed to be coming from Donald Trump. He then – there's this discussion about how allegedly he intimidated her into releasing this earlier statement denying the relationship to it. And that, again – that's not part of the agreement under any sort of interpretation. She was not obliged to release statements, you know, denying it, not obliged to use particular wording. And so it could be a strategic decision by Mr. Avenatti that Stormy Daniels thus far has ability under the existing breaches by Mr. Cohen to talk about the substance of the agreement, to talk about the substance of the affair, but does not yet have enough of a basis that he's willing to risk the potential consequences of releasing a text message or releasing an image or releasing a video or something of that nature. So this could be a calculated risk decision on his part.
All right. To the phones we go. As promised, David in Kensington. You are live on Radio Times. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning. Mine's a fairly simple question. What would his chief strategically or with respect to maybe which clocks are ticking on the agreement if they actually forced Trump's hand and said, hey, why don't you go ahead and find this thing? You know, if we think it's not in effect because you haven't signed it, then could you please step up and sign this? And what would that create for the different sides in this whole debate and issue? I was just curious about that, whether that's a good move or not.
David, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Francis, again, Mr. Trump, President Trump is fairly removed from this. He's not saying much about this. Do you think that it would...
He expressed, a little frustration yesterday, but you're absolutely right. A president who generally tweets and responds instantaneously to provocations of any kind has been very silent about this. To the caller's point of view, I don't know the answer, and I think Max may be able to help with that. But one of Avenatti's strategies was to offer to send the $130,000 back. And, of course, that was not accepted by Cohen and his lawyers. That offer was not accepted. Again, it was a very public statement that he made in offering to do that. I think one of the strategies here is that by making things public, he has forced a couple of apparent errors on the part of the White House. So Sarah Sanders, earlier on during the issue over arbitration, made a comment to reporters that the arbitration had been decided in the president's favor, apparently linking him to all of this. So sometimes by surfacing things, by having people speak out loud, they inadvertently arm the other side. They can give things away. They can make mistakes. And I think that's probably one of the strategies going on here by making things so public.
So, Max, to David's question, there's no way legally that you can force the president's hand in this to have him sign this agreement.
No, you couldn't force him to sign the agreement. He's moving to, or presumably he will move to enforce it. That, again, assumes that he is the person involved, the David Dennison there. You know, there was, as Francis mentioned, Mr. Avenatti's offer to return all of the money and have the agreement declared void. You know, Mr. Trump could, in theory, go and just sign it now. Now, that said, that still wouldn't answer all of the questions. You know, we'd first have this issue of Michael Cohen talking publicly about the agreement and allegedly taking steps to compel Ms. Clifford to deny the affair, which is its own independent argument for it. And then we reach, again, with the walking, talking bar exam, we reach a question of the enforceability of this $1 million per breach liquidated damages. You know, liquidated damages in which you have a contract that says in advance, you know, we will penalize you this much if you break the contract.
So is Stormy Daniels now liable for $21 million since she made her 21st, I think, comments addressing this alleged story?
You could write a law review article about just that one question. Because you first have the issues of having him having it be enforceable. You have the issue of him being a party to it. You have the issue of if she's allowed to breach it now or if they've breached it by their discussions before her revealing it. And then you have this question about the $1 million damages. You know, courts will recognize liquidated damages clauses, but they must be reasonable and they must bear some sort of relationship to it. And, you know, personally, as a lawyer, when I look at $1 million per breach liquidated damages clause against an individual, that's just an intimidation tactic. And you would be hard-pressed to find a judge or an arbitrator who would just rubber stamp $1 million per breach and say, that's it, that's what you owe. You know, there's a much more complicated process for establishing the enforceability of liquidated damages. And then, of course, is something that you know, defendants can do all the time, which is Stormy Daniels could take a judgment against her for $20 million, declare a bankruptcy. And unless Trump could establish that it was willful and malicious what she did, which is the bankruptcy code for it, then that debt itself would be wiped away as part of her bankruptcy. So again, we're back to the bar exam that follows around Donald Trump every single day.
So, Francis, I just want to get to a comment that we had up on the screen a moment ago from, I believe the name was Joe, and he had said something along the lines of, you know, Trump's base is not going to care about this. I mean, what do you think? I'm inclined to say, you know, probably some of, at least as an observer, many of his hardcore members of his base are not going to, you know, they're going to brush this off. What do you think as an observer?
So it's absolutely true that one of my colleagues, of course, was the person who wrote about the Access Hollywood tape that was before the election, and it did not have a big impact on his strong evangelical base in particular. Some of those people have said, you know, if they knew of something more recent, they could be concerned about it. But I think you're absolutely right that the salaciousness, the old allegations about affairs back in 2006 are not going to bother them. If there are issues of campaign finance and other things right before the election, it could turn some people, I think. So there are, you know, there are legal issues that are being raised by this beyond the evidence or of affairs that could reach and affect people.
All right. We're talking about last night's 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels. Anderson Cooper was the interviewer. And we're talking about what's known about Trump's alleged affair with the adult film star and what effect this might have on the presidency. Here with us this hour, Francis Sellers of The Washington Post and trial lawyer Max Kennerly. And we invite you to stay with us as we continue to address this topic through the hour. Again, the number to call is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to join us, this is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about last night's 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels regarding her alleged affair with civilian Donald Trump about 12 years ago. In studio with us, Philadelphia-based lawyer Max Kennerly, and Francis Sellers is a senior writer at The Washington Post. And the number again to call is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to send us an email, it's radiotimes@whyy.org. So let's begin this final segment with a comment from Christian, who says, President William Jefferson Clinton set the precedents for presidential sexual perversion. As he says, Trump is just following the set precedents. And Max, let's bring other White House misbehavior or alleged misbehavior on the part of President Trump into the conversation here. Do you see any parallels? Are these the salaciousness, perhaps, but I mean legal parallels between these two stories?
I would say there is a sense of legal parallel, and it's not quite the same. You know, the Monica Lewinsky scandal with President Clinton ended up going all the way towards impeachment. Yep. But, you know, if we put aside the impeachment aspect of it and that was an employee within the White House while he was president, there is a parallel here between the underlying source of that impeachment proceeding, which was the supposed perjury of, you know, depends on what the meaning of is and not giving an answer about this in a civil case, and with Donald Trump's silence here about the agreement and the representations from his lawyer, Michael Cohen. You know, we do have a parallel issue here of Mr. Trump and Mr. Clinton not being entirely honest and giving the same story with the court system and about what occurred here. You know, that's the this question about the effect on his base of, you know, there's an old saying from Cicero about silence is not an admission, but it is also not a denial. And it is kind of unique to see this situation in which Donald Trump is not out there and just, you know, talking up a storm and, you know, specifically attacking whoever it is that's making the allegation, or at least for the Access Hollywood tape, you know, conceding it and calling it locker room talk. You know, the silence here in many ways is off brand for him. He's not going on the attack as much as he normally does. So it's perhaps a sense of weakness. But, you know, in the legal parallels for this of, you know, you really need to have a straight story. Like when you're under oath, when you're in front of a court, and here we don't have a straight story on where this money came from and what its purpose was.
And we're going to go to our callers in just a moment, but I did want to bring Francis just another angle of this into the conversation, because I know you've been covering the story of Summer Zervos. There have been other women who have come forth with allegations. She's got a defamation lawsuit against President Trump. She says that there was a 2007 sexual encounter with him at the Beverly Hills Hotel. He forcibly kissed and groped her. This is according to Summer Zervos. And her lawsuit has been allowed to proceed. As you write, New York Supreme Court Justice Jennifer Schechter cited precedent from the Paula Jones case against President Clinton. That case, of course, led to his impeachment 20 years ago. So from what you've been able to determine, are there some parallels in the Zervos case?
You're raising exactly the issue I was going to bring up. Of course, the Paula Jones case showed that the president didn't have immunity in federal court. That was the issue that allowed the Monica Lewinsky to come up, the deposition and everything else. The Summer Zervos case was brought in state court, and the argument that was brought forward by the president's lawyers was that the president did have immunity in state court. And the New York judge just last Tuesday, the same day we saw Stormy's polygraphs, the same day that Karen McDougal filed suit. So the New York judge last Tuesday said that the president, no one is above the law, that the state court did have jurisdiction over the president. That's a huge issue, I think. Not surprising to many lawyers, but had the president's lawyers won on that, it would have made the president immune for all sorts of activity while he was president, which would have been quite extraordinary. So last week was a lot of troubling news, I think, for the White House in these areas, and does raise a parallel between the issues being brought forward by women today and the Clinton era.
Well, let's get back to the phones. Ben in Philadelphia, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome.
This seems to me to be a colossal case of mishandling and turning nothing into something. Essentially, they had a one-night stand. It was consensual. It wasn't a relationship. No money changed hands. It was 12 years before the election. And the way in which Trump and his campaign and his advisors have handled it have turned nothing into this major issue that nobody would have cared about had they not tried to do it. I don't understand what their scheme was, except they didn't want Melania to learn about it. That's all I can think about.
Ben, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And he parallels what a comment we have from Sue, who says she's questioning the use of the word affair in this case. It was a one-time event, correct? That's at least what Stormy Daniels was saying last night on 60 Minutes. She also says she's appalled at the Stormy Daniels story, but that's a separate sentiment. But has the Trump camp mishandled this, Max?
I think they definitely have mishandled this. I mean, I think going all the way back to, you know, if we presume that intimidation effort was connected to Trump, and I'm not saying we have this proven or confirmed, it would also be, you know, something that wouldn't warrant being on The Sopranos. This botched intimidation attempt, and then moving forward to the nature of this agreement, the rushed timing of it, you know, having to establish Mr. Cohen having established he had the money, you know, the statements by Mr. Cohen about where the money came from, which then prompted Stormy Daniels to come forward, you know, intimidating her into denying it. I agree completely that there is a large element of mishandling here, and this could have been essentially nothing years ago. And, you know, I say it nothing in terms legally of, you know, if they had reached this agreement, not with that same sort of rush, not with these sort of shell corporations, not without failing to disclose it, then it would have been, you know, affair versus one night stand. That's nomenclature of, I consider it extramarital relations as an affair. So, but I don't presume to define what the word means, yeah. But, you know, legally, it could have been much less of an issue. It would have maybe been a question about, you know, Trump's moral fitness or however it is we'd like to mm-hmm. refer to this for a presidential candidate, but it did not need to be this sort of a legal brouhaha.
All right. Rick in Warminster, you are next. Good to have you on Radio Times with us, Rick.
Oh, yeah, great. Thanks a lot. It's a wonderful discussion. I was just going to say, as we draw parallels with different characters in this, I remember going way back to media law, that there was a there's a citation called U.S. versus Sullivan, and it's very, very difficult to bring up any type of libel against public figures. And I think old Stormy's a public figure, of course, the president's a public figure, but there's been many, many, many attempts at this. But I think right now mishandling is a good way to present it. And I think that U.S. versus Sullivan still stands after all these many years involving public figures involved in similar events like this.
Thanks, Rick. What do you think? Public figures. So does this then stymie the effort forward on those who would like to see this case pushed forward?
So that's Sullivan versus New York Times about the defamation of a public figure and the requirement that a plaintiff establish actual malice, which, you know, being the law, doesn't actually mean malice. It means either ill intent or reckless disregard for the truth. And Donald Trump is definitely a public figure. Stormy Daniels is probably a limited purpose public figure in the sense of this particular discussion and a relationship with Donald Trump is, you know, a matter of public concern. And it is difficult, but it's not impossible to overcome that barrier. Now, I think this factors in many ways, to say 60 Minutes and the airing of it. You know, there was an effort to try and stop them from producing or publishing the story at all. And that's where New York Times versus Sullivan ends up with its strongest power of, no, Anderson Cooper was not, you know, showing a reckless disregard for the truth, mm-hmm. nor was 60 Minutes. And so in terms of the contracts, it gets a lot different. Because they're discussing, you know, Stormy Daniels is alleging that the contract should not be enforceable, that it should be invalidated, whereas Essential Consultants and Michael Cohen and then presumably Donald Trump are trying to enforce its terms. So they, in their legal dispute, have not quite reached this level of defamation. They are more fighting within the arena of contract law.
Let's get back to the president's publicity woes. Frances Sellers, of course, is the case of Karen McDougal, the former Playboy playmate who's not suing the president, but rather the publisher of the National Enquirer for the right to talk about an affair she says she had with Mr. Trump. Frances, what's the latest on this?
So this is a very interesting contrast to see Stormy Daniels last night not saying that she was in love with the president, not expressing any particular emotion, not saying she was attracted to him in any way, compared with Karen McDougal, who was interviewed by Anderson Cooper also possibly 72 hours, 3 days beforehand, very different emotional, saying she was truly attached to him, worrying about the impact she was having on his relationship with his own wife. One of the characters who's maintained her own voice throughout all of this, of course, is Stormy on her Twitter feed, which is where she has shown herself to be resilient, to embrace the criticism she receives and to feed it back. And I spoke with Stormy briefly on Saturday evening about just before she was going into, or she knew that the interview would be aired, and was very struck by somebody who said to me she developed a thick skin by being in the porn industry and a little bit of a dark sense of humor and was able to sort of withstand some of the criticism and even sort of apparently enjoy it and fight back against it. And she said, the one time I felt she was a little bit emotional was she said she was quite overwhelmed by the support she had received. People with it, tweeting with the hashtag Team Stormy and I believe her and I'm with you, this sort of thing. So, you know, the characters of the women who have made these allegations has come out in very different ways in the past week.
So we have Zervos, we have McDougal, we have Daniels. Again, Francis, does all this in this, I'm going to ask for perhaps a little opinion again as an observer, damage the president with the electorate?
Again, very hard to tell, right? We will. We know how he survived Access Hollywood. He doubled down and went ahead. Of course, it was immediately after that that he allegedly tried to silence or that Cohen apparently tried to silence Stormy Daniels. So, you know, there was some damage control apparently going on then.
All right, back to the phones. Jim in Media, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. One quick question, indirectly a quick question. Who gets to pay all the legal court costs associated with this case for, you know, this in general? Basically, if Mr. Trump gets to pay for it, that's fine. If the general public gets to pay for it, then it should be cause for direct impeachment for his lack of control of his little head.
All right. Well, Jim, we appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's talk about John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public. Do we need to pick up the tab for this? And what do you think, Max?
Well, right now, all of the lawyers for both sides, Stormy McDaniels and for President Trump, are paid out of their own pockets. Now, I don't know if, you know, Stormy Daniels, I don't know her resources. You know, maybe Mr. Aventi has some sort of contingent fee because he's going to bring a damages claim. I don't know that side of it. But currently, that's they'd be paying for their own lawyers for this. And, you know, the arbitration, the agreement itself that they have, if it ends up being enforceable, does have a provision for a shifting of legal fees where the loser has to pay for the winner's legal fees. Now, in terms of the public, you know, they are paying for this in some sense, which is among other things. You know, we were talking earlier about the White House press secretary, Ms. Sanders, is discussing this issue. You know, it's unlikely that Donald Trump has a clear divide within the White House of this is an issue that only Mr. Cohen deals with on my personal tab. It is likely involving Mr. McGahn, the White House counsel. It's likely involving a lot of his staff and his advisors to bring into this kind of overall contextual defense. So it does have – it likely has a drag on the public, you know, coffers because of these resources being used. But at the same time, that was Clinton versus Jones. That was what the Supreme Court's decision was, which is, well, yeah, civil litigation is going to end up putting some sort of pull or drag on the president, but too bad. No one is above the law. So, you know, in many ways, it's the price we pay for having no one above the law is that, well, there may end up being some degree of interference with government functions at the highest level because of this.
So, Frances,
I have a little ad.
Oh, go ahead. Sure.
Stormy Daniels has her own online fundraising tool set up by her lawyer, as does Summer Zervos, where they've been raising funds. Last week, I spoke to another women's rights attorney, Lisa Bloom, who said to me, and I wrote a story about this, we need a rich patriot to come out and promise to indemnify these women for fees and penalties they might incur if they speak. So there's a definite move out there, either to get support, as Lisa Bloom requests, from a rich patriot, or to gather support more broadly, as Gloria Allred has done on behalf of Summer Zervos and Michael Avenatti on behalf of Stormy Daniels, to pay some of their legal costs through these online fundraising tools.
Any sign that rich patriot is stepping forward, Frances?
Not that I have seen, but you can track the amount of money that the other women are raising on their online tools.
And where does the investigation go from here as far as a reporter's standpoint is concerned? What are the angles that are being looked into?
Oh, I think everybody will try to follow up on the, you know, any new information that came out last night in the CBS interview. And, of course, there is an interest to see if there will be, as Lisa Bloom suggested somewhat last week, other women coming forward at some point. There are many lines of investigation here for reporters.
All right. Frances Sellers, thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times today. Frances
Thank
Sellers,
you very much.
You're welcome. Frances Sellers is a senior reporter for The Washington Post. And Max Kellerly, Kennerly, we really appreciate you joining us here in our studio in Philadelphia.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Max Kennerly is a trial attorney in Philadelphia. And that about wraps it up for the hour. A reminder to check out our Facebook page and our podcasts. You'll find everything at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.